prayer to bring a prayer book, it would be okay.
I want to welcome all of you this morning, and it is true that we are starting a new direction today. We have, I don't think there are any visitors in here today, so I won't take as long to remind you of where we've come from. We've been looking at characteristics of Jesus. We've looked in James, we've looked in Galatians at the fruit of the Spirit, and we come today to the Beatitudes. If you'll find the book of Matthew and find chapter 5. This is the front end of the Sermon on the Mount. In my translation it says, seeing the crowds, he went up the hill. That's why they call it the Sermon on the Mount. There he sat down and was joined by his disciples, and he began to speak. And this is what he taught them. How happy are the poor in spirit, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. How happy are those who mourn, they will be comforted. How happy are the gentle, some translations say meek. They shall have the earth for their heritage. Happy are those who hunger and thirst for what is right. They will be satisfied. How happy are the merciful. They will have mercy shown to them. Happy are the pure in heart. They will see God. How happy are the peacemakers. They will be called the sons of God. How happy are those who are persecuted in the cause of righteousness. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. How happy are you when people abuse you and persecute you and speak all kinds of falsehoods against you on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward will be great in heaven. This is how they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Now, what I propose to do today is to set the stage for looking at the Beatitudes. And in order to do that, there's a couple of places I have to take you first. So, number one, why did Jesus come into the world? What was God's purpose in sending Jesus? Some people say it was to make bad people good. Scripture doesn't agree. Scripture says Jesus came to make dead people come alive. In Ephesians chapter 2, Paul is speaking, and Paul is Jewish, and he's speaking to Jewish Christians, and he's speaking to Christians who have come out of a Gentile background. And he says to the Jewish, to the Gentile Christians, you were dead. And then about two verses later, he says, we were too, speaking of the Jewish Christians. And then about a verse or two after that, he said, but God in his faithful love to us through Jesus Christ made us alive, gave us a place, raised us up. The purpose of Jesus Christ coming to earth was not to make bad people good. It was to make dead people alive. There's a very big difference between those two. One focuses on behavior, external things. One looks instead at what's going on inside. Now, how are we supposed to find that life? The Beatitudes is one of the best places to look for the answer to that question. And so that's what we're going to work on. What are the keys in here to really being alive that we can begin to understand and take advantage of? Now, in order to do that, we're going to have to talk a little bit about something else. And what we're going to talk about is probably best introduced with a joke. So I apologize for this. But the story is told that about 50 or 60 years ago, there were people living up in the hills of East Tennessee. That's where I came from. And one of the families way back in one of the hollows sent their son to the University of Tennessee for his college education. And he came back after his first year. There hadn't been enough money to bring him home midterm. He came back after his first year, sat at the dinner table, and his dad looked at him and said, so son, you've been at college for a year. What have you learned? And the son said, I have learned that pi r squared. Father looks at him and said, well, we're clearly not going to ever send you back. Everybody knows pi r round. Cornbread, I swear.
Circles, wheels, cycles.
I want to talk about those things. Barbara and I had Carter this weekend. If you don't know, and I haven't told you lately, Carter is our 4-year-old grandson. And he's here through most of tomorrow. So last night, we went down to Dock Street, and we went on board the Godspeed. There's a young couple in the first hour. We were in line. They closed the line behind us, and they came walking by. And so I sort of went like this. Actually, no, I tried to get their attention to see if I could sneak them in. But we got on board the Godspeed. And after we had been on the Godspeed, we came off and went on the Virginia. Now, the Virginia is a schooner that's out of Norfolk, and the keel was laid back in maybe 2002, and it went into the water in 2004. So this is it's a sailing ship, but it's fairly recently built. The Virginia has a steering wheel. The Godspeed does not. What does the Godspeed have? It has not a rudder. You don't hold the rudder. The rudder's down in the water. It has, well, they both have sails. It has a tiller. Okay? It's a big stick. It's about this big around. It's, you know, it's had some shape to it. It's not just a stick. Beautiful wood. And it's about maybe 4 or 5 feet long, maybe this big around. And, you know, you move it like this in order to turn the rudder and turn the ship. You walk to the steering wheel in the Virginia, and my grandson, of course, wanted to turn the steering wheel. So he's sitting there turning the steering wheel. I said, Carter, which way is the front of the boat? And he's sitting there holding the steering wheel, and he goes, that way. I said, no, front of the boat is that way. Well, here's the steering wheel. There's a big shaft on the steering wheel going back to the back of the boat. Why does the shaft go to the back of the boat so that when you stand at the wheel, you're looking at the stern? Why is that? Because the steering wheel is still turning a rudder, right? And the rudder is at the back of the ship. So the shaft goes back towards where the rudder is. What you're supposed to do is stand off to the side, because if you stand directly in the middle, all you can see is the line of masts. You can't see down the ship, so you stand off to the side, so you can see what's at the front. The sailors were there, and they taught us this. Okay? But there's a wheel. And I was watching that wheel. Sometimes you have, sometimes you don't. I'm told that there were some cultures in the New World that didn't have the wheel. They hadn't figured out that the wheel was a useful tool. So cultures that did have the wheel, sometimes technologically anyway, moved on ahead of them. So I got to thinking about wheels. And if you think about a wheel and you watch a wheel just sort of turning down the road, you think, oh, the wheel is turning. But if you look a little bit more closely, you may find something very interesting. And that is, if you have a wheel and you focus your attention on a spot on that wheel, and now you watch the wheel turn, but you focus your attention on that spot. Where does that spot go? Sort of cycles between low and high. That's what cosines and sine functions and trigonometry were built for. That's what calculus can do, is tell you something about things like that. Okay? So what I need you to know is that if you think about wheels, it may look simple, but if you look more tightly, you look at a spot on the wheel, a part of the wheel, that can get pretty complicated. That's all I need you to know. You got that much? You got that much? Okay, now we're going to move to the second thing. We drove to Dock Street in a car, and the car's got wheels, right? But Ezekiel talks about things that have wheels inside of wheels, inside of wheels, inside of wheels, right? Are there wheels anywhere else in the car except at the four corners where the wheels are turning? Sure. Absolutely. You got flywheels and drive wheels and drive shafts and things like that. And some of those wheels are round cylinders, right? You got the engine up at the front. If you happen to have a rear wheel car, which I found out Mustang convertibles have rear wheel drive. I didn't know that until I went and test drove a Mustang convertible. Considering one, it's exciting. I don't think I'm going to buy one, but I did consider one. But you got the engine in the front, the wheels in the back. Somehow the power has to get to here from the engine. And so there's a drive shaft, an axle, if you will. Sorry, there's an axle. then there's some kind of a coupling back here where you take something that's turning, coming from the engine, and you change the angle. I think it's a universal joint. Is that what it's called? I forget where the universal joint is. And then back up here somewhere, you've got the drive shaft turning. That's coupled to some kind of a crankshaft. Only if you've got a transverse engine, the crankshaft is turning this way. But there's wheels within wheels within wheels. I want to look at the crankshaft for a minute. If you don't know about internal combustion engines, just enjoy the show while we work with people who do know something about this. What is the crankshaft doing as it turns? Now, it's sort of a cylinder with funny shape to it, but it's basically turning like this. And what is it doing when it turns? It's lifting and dropping and lifting and dropping the piston. We don't talk about that as a wheel or as a circle, but we just talk about it as cycles. The piston goes up, the piston goes down, the piston goes up, the piston goes down, up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down, cycle, cycle, cycle. Right? What happens as the piston goes up? First, you have some exhaust valves open and you blow out the bad stuff, the combustion products from the combustion that just took place. And then those valves close and injectors come on, other valves open, you bring air in, you bring other things in. I don't remember exactly how all this works, but you end up with a mixture of gasoline and air or diesel fuel and air that's being compressed, right? And as the piston gets near the top, what happens? Spark plug fires if you're in a gasoline engine, or the mixture just becomes explosive and it just blows up if you're in a diesel engine. There's not a spark plug in there, I've told. Is that right? Good. My explanation is good. Now, when does, if you're in a gasoline engine, when does the spark plug fire? Now, pause for a second as you mull over that question and think about the movie My Cousin Vinny and think about Marissa Tomei, because that's your only hope, most of you, for understanding this. Remember what she talked about? There was that one moment where the guy asked her the question.
Yeah.
What's the timing on a so-and-so Chevrolet? And she talks about top dead center. What's top dead center? That's the highest point the piston makes in its travel. Well, the spot is at the top of the wheel. And some engines, it's just a little before top dead center, just a little after. And remember, the piston's only doing this, right? What do you measure when it happens? You measure it in degrees. Before or after, 4 degrees after, 2 degrees before top dead center, you get the timing worked out. Okay? So there's this thing that, what happens after the spark plug goes up and after the piston reaches the top? Now you got the downstroke, right? What happens during the downstroke? Now the explosion is going on and you're pushing the piston down. That's forcing the crankshaft to turn, and as the crankshaft is forced to turn, that turns all the things, which eventually turns the wheels, and that gives you the drive power. And then it turns around. You're doing that cycling, cycling, cycling. So here's what you need out of that. You don't need much out of that, but you need just this much. That as you think about cycles, wheels, and circles, and all this kind of stuff, you may find different things happening in one part of the cycle that happen in another, but they still fit together into some coherent whole that does something for you. You got it? Let's review. What do you have so far? As you look at the circle, as you look at wheels running down the road, it may look simple, but if you follow what's happening in one particular part, it may be complicated. That's all you need from the first part. What do you need from this part?
Pistons go up and down.
What you find is that during a cycle, there may be things happening in one half of the cycle, and different things happen in the other half of the cycle, and the two together make some kind of coherent whole. Right? We got it. And, you know, you can't have this part over here without this part, or you can't have this part without this part. They're working together, but the idea is that sometimes you can take circles or cycles or wheels and cut them in half and see things happening in one half and then other things happening in the other half. Right? Let's review. You watch a wheel go, it looks simple, you follow one particular spot, it can get complicated. And as you watch things, you may sometimes find yourself cutting a circle or a cycle in half and seeing some things in the first half and seeing some other things in the second half together that make a whole. Upstroke, downstroke for the piston and the crankshaft and all that. Got it?
Yeah.
All right. Now, number three, we need color. What's color?
Light.
You're wearing
Turquoise.
Turquoise. Okay. And she's wearing?
Teal.
There was a fellow when I was at UVA, there was a fellow one time who, I don't know how much chemistry he ever understood, but every color that he saw, he described with a word I had to look up in the dictionary. You know, teal, magenta, citron, I think was one that he used, but that may have been a flavor. Color is a term that we normally apply to things that our eye can detect. I wore the closest I could get to a red shirt today. Maybe more pink or something like that, right? And I see a red back here, and I see an orange here, and I thought it was blue, but I'll take your word for it. If I said aquamarine or something like that, okay? Our eye perceives color, and we got names for colors, right? Anybody remember a mnemonic that teaches you those names or reminds you of those names? Very good.
Roy, R, O, Y, G, V, I, B, Roy, G, P.
What's the R stand for? What's the G stand for?
Green.
What's the I stand for? The cow drank ink and mooed.
Think about it for a minute. The cow drank ink and mooed indigo.
You have to be old and remember the Big Bang Theory. So what color is over here? What color is over here? Only we say it black. We say infrared. And we abbreviate IR. Okay.
Wow.
What's over here? Beyond. Or above or something like that. Violet, which we call ultra. Violet, not violet, but UV, right? What color is that? We don't know because our eye can't perceive it, so we don't have a name for it. What's the difference between these colors of light?
Frequency.
Uh-huh. And just out of curiosity, which way does frequency go? Higher frequency over here or higher frequency over there?
Higher
frequency. Longer wavelength, whatever that means. Longer wavelength. And it turns out that energy is really the one that correlates. Higher energy is the one that correlates. But there's a problem with that. And let me illustrate the problem for a moment. Let's imagine just for a moment that I had a nickel, and I placed a nickel here. And I took a $100 bill, and I placed the $100 bill here. And then I set up monetary quantities on a scale between these guys. So there'd be a place for dimes, and a place for quarters, and a place for Kennedy half dollars, and a place for Sagittarius, and a place for $5 bills, and $10 bills, and $20 bills, and $50 bills, and $40 bills. Well, no. They only use those in East Tennessee. There'd be places along through there, right? Which one of those has the most monetary value? The $100. Which one has the least monetary value? The ones down here, I think maybe be pennies beyond that. Right? If I brought in 65 tons of pennies, and I don't know how much space it would take, let's say it would take just half of the room, how much money would there be there? Starts with L.
Lots.
If I brought $200 bills and put them on this side of the room, how much money would there be?
$200.
Which side of the room would have more money?
The
65 tons of nickels, I guarantee you that's going to have any more money. I guarantee you that's going to be more money. The intrinsic value of a nickel versus the intrinsic value of a $100 bill, I'll add to my scale like this. But if I get a whole lot of these, I can have a whole lot of total energy. This is a scale of intrinsic energy. If I've got really bright red light, I can carry a whole lot of energy with that. If I've got really dim violet light, I'll get very little energy carried. Total. But this little idea of the intrinsic energy of light tells you that light acts like it's lumps. You get a lump of light, and then you get another lump, and then another lump, and you add those things up. Intensity adds it up. Color tells you what each lump carries. Like nickels, or like $20 bills, or like $100 bills. So far, okay? Your eye can detect the lump. Bright or dim, red is red. Bright or dim, green is green. Your eye detects where that lump is in terms of its intrinsic quality and how much by how bright the thing seems to be. I need to put on shades because it's really bright. Or my pupils open up real big because it's really dim. But your eye can detect those differences. So far, okay?
What did you say R stood for?
R stood for red. And O stood for orange. Now, the thing that's fascinating about this, this is what we teach in chemistry, is that if you have, and much of the time, it's not all the time, but much of the time this is true, if you see a color, you're not ever seeing the color that's being absorbed by whatever the object is. You're seeing the complementary color. And the only way to really see that is to draw a color wheel.
Red, orange, yellow. Green, blue, indigo, violet.
Now, I can't draw things that have seven wedges to them. I do well to draw one that has six. So I've got seven colors, I've got six things to put in, I've got to do something somewhere. I chose to do it there. Right. So if I look at my red shirt or your red shirt, or maybe even yours, there's a little different quality in it of what's there. If you've got more than one color absorbed, it's way more complicated. We're not going to talk about it. But if there's only one color absorbed, if you absorb blue, you'll see red. And that doesn't make any sense from this, but it does make sense from this. If you absorb red, you see the complementary color, the opposite color on the color wheel. See how that works? If you see orange, then what's being absorbed? Probably somewhere around whatever's called indigo. No, that's the color of the little fixture you put on to glow at night in the bathroom. Indigo. Okay? Sort of got that. Now, this came alive to me in the courses I teach, but it really came alive to me about a year ago. I made it all the way through college and all the way through high school, taking a single course in biology as a sophomore in high school. I took no courses in biology when I was in college or in graduate school. None. My only course in biology was from a high school coach when I was a sophomore in high school. That was it. And a year ago, I took a full year of college biology, cell and molecular biology, genetics. I took all of that. It was fascinating. There was one day, the person was talking about this crucial experiment that helped us understand some really important aspects of metabolism. And that whole experiment hinged on being able to detect the presence or absence of glucose. If glucose was present, you saw this yellow color in the system. If glucose was absent, it's colorless. I thought, yellow, that's an odd color. And I started to think, was whatever was absorbing to give the yellow color, was it just not there beforehand? And the answer, as you started listening to what they were saying, was clearly no. Here's what was happening. You had something that was absorbing in the UV. And if it absorbs in the UV, it's colorless because the complementary is not in, wherever the complementary is, it's not in this region. The complementary for these guys are all in this region. It's a closed system. Right? But if you bring glucose in, its properties change just a little bit, and it starts absorbing violet. And if it absorbs violet, what happens? You see yellow. And that was what was happening in that particular crucial experiment. Now, you don't need any of this. Except this one thing. Things that happen at one point in a cycle might have a complementarity to things that happen in another part of the cycle. Do you have that? So let's review. Number one, when you think about wheels, it all looks pretty simple. They just roll down the road. But if you concentrate your attention on one spot, what happens? It can't get complicated. Right? It can't get complicated. Number two, sometimes with cycles, you can divide the cycle in half so that some things happen in one half of the cycle, some other things happen in the other cycle, and together that makes some coherent whole. And then what's the third thing? Things that happen at one spot may have a complementarity to some aspect of some other spot. You got that?
I have a good question. Why, so we can just jump into the scientific aspect, why is just as you crept into the color scale, you were in the violet mode, you would see yellow? Why wouldn't we see violet?
Because violet has its complementary color as yellow. If it absorbs violet, you see yellow.
Okay. It is that way.
Yeah.
You can prove this to yourself, very simply.
But I don't want you to. There's all kinds of optical tricks. There's one came through the internet this week. You have something that's making little spots move. And as the spots are moving, you concentrate on one particular spot. The spots disappear because your cones get tired but can't recycle quickly enough. And all you see is the complementary color. Okay. But I don't need that. All I need is the idea that something happens at one part might have a complementarity to something that happens in another part. So, if you're ready, then I'm ready to talk about the Beatitudes. How many Beatitudes are there? Go count them. Matthew 5. How many Beatitudes are there?
Nine.
Depends on whether you count when he switches from talking about them to you, whether he's talking about a new one. Most folks think he's amplifying the eighth one. So most folks think it's eight. Now, this doesn't look much like a wheel or a circle because I got kicked out of first grade into second grade, so I didn't stay long enough to learn art. But that's more or less. Right? So if this is one, two, three, four, what's the first beatitude have to do with? Those who are
poor
in spirit. What's the second
one?
Well, it depends on the translation. Most translations put more in here, and more I'm getting to the point where I don't like to see more in any other place. It's the complementarity effect that comes in. I'll show you that in just a second. What's the third one? Meek or gentle or gentled is maybe even better. And what's the fourth one? Hunger and thirst after righteousness. Okay. What's the fourth one? Fifth one? You're in art. Sixth? Seventh, I guess?
Peacemaker.
And the last one? Persecuted for the sake of righteousness. There's your cycle. And the cycle breaks into two parts. I don't want to call it an upstroke or a downstroke, but you can sort of see something like that. Right? There is a complementarity that I will show you in just a minute. Let me back up and try to show you the basics of this first. First of all, what's happening with these four? Poor in spirit, mourn. Meek or gentle, hunger and thirst after righteousness. It may be easier to see here. Another word for poor in spirit might be humility or humble. What are these characteristics associated with? Well, let me help you.
Behaviors.
These? Yeah. I don't think so. Merciful. What is the evidence that someone is merciful? What's the evidence that someone is merciful?
Forgiving.
Forgiving who?
Others.
What's the evidence that somebody is peacemaker? Some kind of conflict, lowering or resolution in a community of others. Now, the peacemaker may be part of that community or may be a mediator external to the community, but others. It's a little harder to see this one, but it's pretty easy to see these three. These all involve others. So these are outer or external. These over here. Inner. Internal. What's the effect of these things? These four, the key to these is my need. The key to these is my need. Easier to see here and here and here maybe than here, but the key to these is my need. When I am poor in spirit, when I mourn, when I am meek, when I hunger and thirst after righteousness, what does God do about it? What's God do about it? God begins to meet my needs. The praise that emerges, my praise that emerges, is praise to God, God for His sufficiency. Did Travis mention to you today about the woman in his little church in Kentucky that used to sing for funerals? What was the most requested song? How great they are. Praising God that He is able. He's got the ability to do the things that I need Him to do. He does the things for me that only He can do and that I need desperately. As I begin to realize the problems that these connect to, my mind turns to God, and God responds. God responds by revealing Himself to me. I learn more about Him. I understand more about Him. His Spirit, I want to say it this way, becomes alive, becomes effective, becomes active in my life. I'm saying it with the word my so that it's personal to me. I want you to say my as well so it becomes personal to you. Okay? God responds by revealing Himself to me. God takes me into deeper relationships. And in that process, He meets my needs. And He meets my needs by building a deeper relationship with Him. In the building of a deeper relationship with Him, what has happened to me? I change. And I become more like Jesus. Some of Jesus' characteristics began to grow in me. I began to reflect God's image. I began to behave more like Jesus would behave. And that culminates in a yearning that however deep it's gone, it needs to go further. There is a yearning for God. So what happens on this side? Think
result.
Complementarity. What's the key? What's the key? The key is my giving to meet the needs of others. What has happened is that my mind has turned to others. And what does God do? It's crucial. This is the one you meant to say. What does God do? Over there, my mind turns to my needs and then to God, who is the only one able to meet my needs. This time my mind turns to others. Over there, God began to respond by revealing himself to me. What's God do here?
Reveals himself to others.
How?
Through
me. You hear? I can't give what I don't have. If I jump into this side without this, I'm doing these things out of my own power, not out of God's power. I'm doing this out of whatever resources I have access to, not his resources. So God begins to reveal himself to others, but he does it through me. I thought about casting this whole thing as through us. I don't want to do it that way, because it needs to be very, very individualized for me and for you. God begins to reveal himself to others through me, and thereby he begins to meet their needs. It's probably important to remind ourselves of something that I talked about a few weeks ago and that I'll continue to talk about every once in a while. You hear people sometimes praying, God, fill me with your power. And it sounds like they want to be spiritual batteries. Go to the recharge center, get yourself filled with power, then go out to where the need is. God never wants us to be that. What does he want us to be? Extension cords. Always in connection with God. And then, when you're at the place where the need of others exists, God's power doesn't come from you. It comes from God through you. All of them are between those two things.
Yeah.
Is there a corresponding phrase on this side?
Mm-hmm.
But I think I can show you that best by first going here. What's the culmination of this side? You begin to realize no matter how much God has revealed, there's more. And you want to go always deeper into your relationship with him. There's a yearning that's built that never stops. What happens on this side? And it's hard to see in these words up here, but it's here. Can you see it yet?
You're yearning for others.
I begin to identify with Jesus. And the world begins to identify me with Jesus, and therefore begins to treat me the way the world treated Jesus. And the world has always treated God's representative.
Sure.
That's what this is talking about.
The right side reminds me, I can't remember the name of it, but it's whenever I look at the altar, and it's like Jehovah Hammon, the God of Mormon.
Jireh? I think.
Like, he's more than enough.
The God who provides.
Yeah.
Now, Bobby, when it comes to praise, the praise I give God is praise for allowing me and enabling me to be of service in the need of other things. In essence, what I do becomes my worship. My worship is no longer separated from what I do, as it might have been here. My worship has gone deeper.
Yeah.
my worship becomes my life. Now, I want to move to the harder part, and this sets the stage for what's coming. What happens when I mourn? If this God is working with that characteristic in my life, what can emerge from that is holiness, which I can offer to the community. What happens if I live a life of meekness, where I am in submission to God? And what Ephesians brilliantly calls mutual submission to each other in the body. What happens when I'm there? Power, the power under control. What happens? I'm enabled to be a peacemaker. I want to say this as carefully as I can. People instinctively, when God comes into your heart, you want to go here. That's part of what God gives you. Is a gift for wanting to go here. But God has also given you spiritual gifts that need to be developed, need to be practiced, need to be. And as you do that, if you never come to this side but only stay here, you're never going to be as effective as if you spend some time there and then come back. You may be doing this for a while, but if you then spend some time back over here, especially here, then when you come back, you're going to be more effective than you ever were before. When you see people with great authenticity, they normally have come out of some kind of experiences here. What was Travis talking about in the worship service this morning? Finding joy when the hard time came. Okay? Why? Because when the hard time comes, if you allow God's work to go on in your life, it can build things in you that enable God to put you to work and for God to become alive in your life in a way that others can see. Your worship can become deeper. Your effectiveness in the service of the Lord can become deeper. Now, what I propose to do over the next few weeks is to come back from this picture to a detailed look at each one of these. But it seemed to me it wasn't going to be nearly as effective to do that and then show you how it all fits together. I had to show you that at first. So this is going to be the backdrop for the things that we're working on for the next little while. As we talk about what it means to be poor in spirit, we're going to be connecting that with, to the extent that God humbles me, I become able to be merciful in God's ways of being merciful. To the extent this hasn't happened, this is not likely to emerge. God gives each of us spiritual gifts. God gives each of us experiences. Those experiences may concentrate in one place, but therefore produces primarily one of these over here. But in time, most people will cycle through most of these. Is this helping you to see something you might not have seen before? I'll make an observation just for what it's worth. If you go take a look at the Ten Commandments, you see something like this. If you go take a look at the Lord's Prayer, you see something like this. This is a big unifying theme across the whole Bible. The Ten Commandments, to the Lord's Prayer, to the Beatitudes. God works within me so that God can work through me. God enables me and equips me. That's a word I should put down over here. Part of this is to equip me and then puts me to work. There's this sense of back and forth. There is a complementarity. More of this has the tendency to produce a special gift or a special service in an area over here. People who are effective peacemakers have almost always come out of an experience that has left them here with great power, but that power under God's control, submitted to God, and in mutual submission to other Christian brothers and sisters. I said I wasn't going to do this, but I am. You've modeled this for me, Russell. I've seen you humble, and I've seen this emerge, and I honor that. And I've seen things like this with other people in one of our two classes. There are things that God does for people coming out of the experiences they have, hard as those times may be, that bring them into an authenticity that I just sit back and marvel. There's something powerful in this story, and we're going to try to explore that for the next several weeks. Okay? Let's have a word of prayer as we finish. Our Father, we thank you that your word teaches us something important about how you want us to find the life that you call us to. Teach us that in order for us to be effective in your service, we need first to be in relationship with you, and that you call us always into deeper relationships. Help us as we go through this study to begin to understand more and more each week of how you want to work with us and how you want to work in us. And more importantly, maybe, how you want to work through us to meet the needs of a watching and waiting world. We pray all these things in your Son's name. Amen.